name's Ryan Miller, and for the past 15 years, I've helped hundreds of people to raise millions of dollars for their funds and for their startups. If you're serious about raising money, launching your business, or taking your life to the next level, this show will give you the answers so that you too can enjoy your pursuit of making billions. Let's get into it.
I probably shouldn't tell you this, but the fastest way to grow your wealth, in my opinion, is to launch your own fund. So my next guest has done just that, leading him to manage money for Goldman Sachs, royal families, and win a ton of awards for doing so. So he's going to walk you through how to launch your own fund so that you too can enjoy your pursuit of making billions. Here we go. Hey, welcome to another episode of Making Billions. I'm your host, Ryan Miller, and today I have my dear friend, Trevor Welsh. Trevor is an award-winning fund manager in venture capital, hedge fund, and private alternative investment strategies. As a former Goldman Sachs private banking manager and money manager for the royal family, he's earned his place as one of the world's top 100 finance leaders in 2023. So what this means is that Trevor has entered God mode in private investments and is in a perfect example of one of the funds that won in his industry. So Trevor, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, I appreciate it. I'm glad to be on, and I have to, like, whatever, superstitious, so I'm not jinxed with that God mode. I need to keep going in the future, man. But grateful to be a participant and love listening to you and finding out how we align, and especially some of the skill set you have that I really need to develop. So I've really appreciated that.
We're all brothers on the path, my man. So we're very fortunate to be in the top 2% in the world. It's all because of amazing guests just like you, my man. So, you know, let's hit them right between the eyes. You've done so many things. I mean, Goldman and, you know, managing money and raising money and working with high net worth, even in royalty. I mean, you've done it all, brother, and you're winning awards. This is amazing. We're going to have a really good show. Folks, you're going to want to stay in the end where Trevor really opens up and gives a lot of his best advice at the end. But before we do, let's get into some advice about beginners. So for people who are just starting out, let's say fund managers, right? This is an area you understand very well. What advice can you give to a beginner who's starting out in two ways? One, how do they win? How do they get early points on the board as a beginner, early emerging fund manager? And two, how do they not lose and blow it all up? What would you say?
Yeah. And I think a lot of it is to separate some of those skill sets. And one of those is looking at what the components are of a fund, whether you are operating the fund, whether you are trying to find an investment that is worthy of someone else trusting their money with you, or whether you're fundraising. And those three components can take three very diverse skill sets: to fundraise, to make the business solvent, to operate and do the operations and get things correct, and then to actually find deals that your brain is able to see something that others can't typically find or understand well enough to make money off of. You've got to combine those three or outsource the things that you're not good at. And so for making money on the investment side, and we'll talk about that as far as, you know, what's key, there's really two things you must do. If you are going to make an outsized return out of like a risk-free plus whatever average of the stock market, bond market, or a private equity portfolio from the risk-reward perspective, what you're looking for, especially in private investments, is to collapse an inefficiency that is existing that other people aren't seeing, whether that's by a technology you're investing in or a company that you see is creating some magnificent inefficient efficiency. Think of something like the internet or where we look at artificial intelligence. These aren't necessarily creating new industries. They're just making certain processes and functions within industries more efficient. Or you find something that has never been done in history that needs to happen, that will benefit human experience, livelihood, or just something they all want, like the iPhone. Like everybody has a phone. People globally have mobile phones. So something that is a new experience or a new way of interacting with each other in society. If you can do one of those two things, collapse an inefficiency or create something that's never been capable before, you can make money for your investors.
Awesome. You know, you and I have been speaking offline a little bit, and I noticed you're a bit of a contrarian. What would you say about, you know, contrarian folks, for those who don't know what it is, basically saying if the market's going up, you're betting it's going down. And when everything's going down, you're betting in the opposite direction. Now that sounds cool, a little cowboyish, but it's not enough to just be a rebel. You got to be right. What's your opinion on just, are you in favor of contrarian? I mean, I think you are, but maybe you can walk me through a little bit of that.
Yeah, it's important as a fund manager, and whether you're emerging or not, to be able to look at something and say, do I have an edge? Is there something that I'm seeing? Because Wall Street overanalyzes everything. And the key, if you're an investment banker, is you need to know every number. You need to know you know, down to the details of what is predicted and what can happen. And if you're on the same side of that opinion, unless you have access to something that will definitely generate money on that same side of a trend or reverting when a trend reverses, and that's in private markets or public, you need to have a very different view from that, or else it's kind of just the median expectation of what the market is going to do. And so unless you can be very confident that you know something that will happen or not happen that is believed, it's tough to replicate that you are going to make anybody money. Meaning, if you can generate somebody a 1% annualized return, that's what a lot of hedge funds, stat arbs are doing anyway. You know, if you're always on the same side of what Wall Street is doing, or if you're always thinking the same, you know, trend of artificial intelligence, well, that's the definition of buying high and selling low, which is the opposite of how you make money. You have to be variant of that. When things are low and nobody wants it, the Warren Buffett method, the intelligent investor method, which I recommend everybody read, if you're going to have very few eggs, you have to watch those eggs carefully that they are going to go the direction that you think they will, long or short.
Perfect. Thank you. You know, when it comes to beginners launching their fund, is there a milestone that you would recommend to emerging fund managers to have where you can finally stop sweating so much? Is there a minimum amount that they should say, look, your first fundraise should be at least this number AUM to cover OPEX or whatever? Do you have any advice on that?
Yeah. When I look at funds and have looked at fund managers, I look at three different risks, whether they're worth it. That's the business risk, the operating the business risk, being able to do it properly, and then the investment strategy, what's really, you know, unique. Well, that business risk, you start to be able to pay the fixed costs and variable costs of a fund at a very minimalistic headcount, which a fund most financial institutions headcount that followed by technology, and that's starting to catch up, are the largest expenses. That's typically for a startup when you're really doing it right and you have the right key players, vendors, and components in place, minimum $25 million of AUM. And that's on a traditional 2-in-20 type structure, you know, and it can vary, but really you're cutting corners on some things that are risking investor capital and your own livelihood. And so you want to try to get as close. In venture capital, you can start lower, but in some hedge fund strategies, you shouldn't start unless you've got more. But typically, I would recommend you want to be about break even on the management fee. So if you're charging a 1% management fee, you're going to need a minimum $50 million. If you're charging 2, you can probably get away with 25. But just to be able to break even on those expected expenses, that's where I would recommend. And there are things you can offset with what the fund will pay. But even then, you don't want somebody. You have to cap how much the fund reimburses your expenses if you're a small fund. And so that's coming out of your pocket.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, brilliant. So $25 million, if you're on a 220 structure, is the first milestone you should shoot for raising capital. And then I would say even those three things that you talked about, that's brilliant. That's also probably the areas where you don't lose, is make sure you got those down. So I think you said business risk, operations, and strategy, correct?
Correct.
All right. So make sure that you know business risk, you know how to run a profitable business. Operating is compliance, audit, all that fun stuff. And then strategy is just your thesis, your deal flow, figuring out your competitive advantage and how to extend that to your investors. So I love that, man. That's really good.
There's individual components of each. And you think of like, well, what's the difference of business risk or operating risk? Business is your fund is your revenue and expense model. And you need to be capable of sustaining that through some really rough periods for maybe 5 to 10 years. You're looking at different components like a venture capital. The average venture capital fund investment is 14 years. The average marriage in the US is 9 to 11 years. So somebody invested in a venture capital fund is more likely to be divorced 1.5 times before they get liquidated of their fund, even though the fund terms could be 8 to 10 years. That is irrelevant to what's owned underneath unless everything's distributed in kind. So being able to know how to operate that can sustain your business when you still have to operate it, when you're not making the revenue because your fund doesn't allow it. And then having those people and those vendors that can, you know, manage a fund properly. For instance, accounting. Most CPAs can't just go into a fund and account for funds, especially in public markets, but even in private, properly. Specific rules and regulations on the legal field of how things can return to investor are it's a specialized field. And so your buddy that might be doing, you know, individual tax returns might not be the best person to do your fund reporting. You will probably misreport to your investors. And likewise with legal, if your guy's a divorce attorney, he's, even if he's a securities attorney and he worked on Wall Street doing, you know, public issuance and opinion letters for restricted stocks, isn't the guy for fund documentation and getting a fund launched or fund counsel.
Brilliant. Yeah. So it sounds like everybody gives a hard time to venture capitalists calling it risky. Turns out it's less risky than marriage, according to those statistics. That's all I heard was venture. You're that venture versus a marriage venture. That's great. All right. Well, let's talk about the market, man. That was phenomenal. So in the market, what are you seeing out there?
Yeah. So things cycle, and it's been a historically long bull cycle. And a lot of that has been because of, you know, money that's made its way into market through credit markets, through private debt funds, and mostly through the Fed. And somebody, it used to be, if you're a fundamental investor, meaning that you're looking at the bottom at core of financials and things that go based on interest rates and things, risk-free rate, it used to be you could predict valuations and things based off of that, those core components. That will come back into vogue, where value investors are you know, important again. Different things with interest rates and the Fed plays a big role. And we see that with inflation, and, you know, the market still reacts every time Jerome Powell, you know, says something. But right now, I think there is either way a lot of volatility for anything that happens, meaning there are assets that are in hyper bubbles that are super, super high. And what happens over long periods of time of rates, you know, maybe skewing where money gets thrown into a market, if you throw, you know, double the money and there's not double the production, well, the prices of each thing produced is double. And that's how inflation works. You get into an environment when multiple economies and central banks are trying to manage that by just injecting more liquidity without ever stopping. The ability to change what rates people borrow at tends to have hyper volatility. And one regime in history that we saw that happened, I was in 1926 Weimar Germany. It would happen again in 1937. It's happened in the 1970s. It's happened kind of low flow in the 1980s. But the ability of all those markets combined to inject more money into, or central banks to inject more money, whether it's through more borrowing or lending, definitely produces a lot more volatility going forward, where smaller economic changes can make a larger, how much does it cost me to borrow, difference. And so while the Fed would like those borrowing rates to come down, they don't want that to create more price inflation, and there's just a balancing act. There's actually a really good book on that called The Age of Turbulence, written by Alan Greenspan, where he explains this in 2005, before the financial crisis, basically saying if you're trying to control for three things that are contrary, like employment and inflation and all these things, that it's not possible and one of them breaks. And I think that's where we see things in markets that volatility gets more extreme, where VIX goes from one level to an extreme level, and that extremity rolls down to private markets, to debt markets, and to everything else that changes asset valuation pretty quickly.
I love that. You know, you remind me of a saying I always like to say. It's really hard being a regulator, and regulators typically, we'll say the Fed in this case, they have a habit of riding the brake, and they keep tapping the brakes till something flies through the windshield. So that's perfect what Alan Greenspan talked about. Say, two of the three passengers have their seatbelt on, but one of them is going to fly through the windshield. We just don't know which one until it does. So thank you for watching. If you've made it this far, we must be friends. So don't forget to like, subscribe, and click that notification button. Now, let's get back to the show. It's not enough to know where it's at, but we also got to have a call. So what's your opinion? What are you seeing out there? Where are the next opportunities looking forward in the market?
Yeah. So in everything I do, I base it on a few components of conditional probability, and different option pricing models matter a lot to me, and not in a Black-Scholes predictive that you would price like a derivative or an option. But in macro markets, in public markets, looking at, you know, the worst case, base case, and best case of any scenario that affects what I'm looking at as an investment. So macro level, different supply demand dynamics, but really looking at things that, regardless of what the Fed does, regardless of what China does, are people going to demand and spend their money on having a better quality of life? I think so. So what are the technologies, what are the biotech, you know, solutions, the pharmaceutical solutions that will durably make that happen, not just in developed markets, but globally? And so as you can implement different things that have worked in certain markets and then find how that works in other markets, that's always a successful trading strategy. I mean, that's one of Chase Coleman of Tiger Global. That's his, a lot of what he does is he's like, you know, we have Amazon, so I invested in these things in India and Brazil, and the roll down that where it works somewhere, that's bound to work somewhere else. Where, how do we express that thesis of ours? And so that's what we do in life sciences, in energy infrastructure. Right now, there's a lot to be done in developed markets and, of course, in third world countries on energy and access to energy. So that's a place that I'm interested in. There's a, and we talked about this once, there's an author and I forgot, it's like Singer or something, but he says that there's a correlation that access to energy has a direct correlation with advancements in society. And if you can access energy, you can create clean water. And if you can create clean water, you can create clean food. And it's just this cycle that revolves. And so we need to be able to solve all those. And that's something that I'm interested in as well. And those are things that geopolitical, those are things that, you know, central bankers, they're not going to stop the trend of making advancements in those places and making good investments that return capital. And that's what we look for.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AI is changing the game of business. Will you be on the winning team? I'm Jordan Wilson, the host of the Everyday AI podcast and your coach to help you learn the X's and O's of AI. Artificial intelligence isn't just a new player in the game, it's a new sport altogether. So if you don't quickly put AI into play, your competitors will run up the score. I've spent my whole life building winning teams, from coaching basketball to working with big players like Nike and Jordan Brand. My next move? Helping you win with Everyday AI. Listen wherever you get your podcasts or on everydayaipodcast.com. Let's tap into AI together and put points on the board.
Yeah, I love that. And that was a big part of why I pursued energy, clean energy, and those types of things in our venture fund, not a solicitation for investment. I'm just saying this was the inspiration to that as well, as to say, look, if you want to do the most good, get into health, invest in biotech, right? This is more of a, from an impact investor like myself, biotech, energy, clean energy, whatever, any of those forms, and then be able to just work with governments and say, look, we know what you need. You know, work with the government of Nepal or anywhere really, and just say, look, if we can help you with that, you know, just point and show us the way. So that's a big vision of ours, is just giving access to help countries. So absolutely love that, brother.
Yeah, I love that. And it's recursive, meaning that different countries, different economies have different challenges that sometimes produce some really interesting technologies. For instance, India has to help care a billion people, and maybe they don't, or a billion plus. And maybe there are inefficiencies there, but they also innovate on some things that are really interesting, like portable ultrasound equipment, where ultrasounds are really impactful for more than we understand, whether it's, you know, plaque in the arteries and things. And so there's a sharing there. And as markets are open, it helps to travel to places, see how things go different places. Like here, you'll see a different adoption rate of things like blockchain and cryptocurrency than you will in markets that have a less efficient financial transactional system. And for them, it's revolutionary, where here in the US, it kind of works well, functionally. And so there's not a need to change it as much, but where it needs to change, you find some innovation that's really interesting.
Thank you for that. So as we round third base, I'm just curious, based on all of your experience, all of the fundraising, all of these amazing things that you've been able to do, I'd love for you to talk about some of the competitive advantages you can provide for our listeners based on all of your experience, maybe two or three things. What competitive advantages would you provide someone who's just starting out, or if they're experienced, either way, what would you say?
Yeah. Somebody said, and I just read this, and so I don't deserve credit. And I wish I should give credit to these, but maybe it was Simon Sinek, but he says, we don't rise to the level of our goals. We always fall to the level of our systems. A competitive advantage for you will be build a system and process of the way that you think through investing. So yes, you need to have a sustainable business. Yes, you need to operate it properly and learn how to do that. But the systems of the way you think will matter more to an investor. It will matter more to the long-term success of how you perform in managing a fund than whether you're right on the price of Bitcoin tomorrow or whether you've got Microsoft stock pegged. The way you come to those decisions and the more articulate you can be on how you come to those decisions will help. I use certain methodologies I learned in grad school at Carnegie Mellon. Carnegie Mellon is very quantitative, as people know. And through that quantitative process, it helped me refine things like economic game theory. So I listened to one, and there's a lot of research on economic game theory about operational research or optimizing systems, processes, and models, but applying that to an investment framework and how you think through the investment framework, the better you can do that, the more articulate and convincing you'll be for an investor to trust you with their money. It's one thing to come with an idea and say, hey, investor, this is a great idea you should invest in. Their ideas are a dime a billion right now, especially with artificial intelligence. But the ability to say, this is the system and process I use to identify new ideas that will durably and replicably make more money on an asymmetric risk return than my competitors. And so what I use is the economic game theory model of decision making. It doesn't work to pick stocks and bonds, but it does work at macro level markets. And that the one that I use is just a combination where I can quantify, you know, the probability I think different markets will move a different way or different decisions, I should say, will go. It works in geopolitics. It works in other areas. And refining it to those 3 to 5, maybe 8 variables that matter. So if you can define 70 to 80% of the success of a system based on 3 to 5 variables that matter, you can then control for those variables and you can decide, do I have an effect? Can I influence, or do I have the ability to mitigate the risk of those variables? Meaning if I want to invest in a consumer product company, and one of the key indicators is the number of doors that can get in, but I can impact that the buyer of Walmart will pay attention to it. Well, maybe I invest in that company. If they've got a good product and I know I can get them into Walmart, and I know the success variable of that is how many doors of retail that they can get in, that would be an example of a variable I can control for. If you can't refine 70 to 80% of the success of a company or an investment down to 3 to 5 variables, you probably don't understand that market or that product well enough to get involved. So you just pass. And I think the more you can do that and articulate that to investors, it will help. The second one I use is that kind of discounting probability optionality model. There's one called Cox, Ross, Rubenstein, where you're looking out into the future and saying, here are the components that are needed. Here are the risks that are possible. And that helps you refine those 5 to 8 variables in a market, in a product, in a company, and be able to affect that.
Yeah, make sure you have a good decision-making process and you run it off a few of those models of game theory. I absolutely love that. So I'm going to look that up, man. I'm going to take your advice. This is great. So what about another one? What else would you say could be a competitive advantage from all your experience? What could you share with someone and kind of point them in the right direction to develop this themselves?
Yeah, it would be, of course, always stay curious of anybody that you're talking to. You can always learn something from everyone. And there are people that are heavily listened to, like, and know the difference, meaning that there are people who are wonderful to get advice from on the way that they think, but never believe that they are more likely to be correct on the actual in way that it is applied in the way that they invest than what your thesis is. Meaning if you have a system and process that you've researched, and maybe you are on the opposite side of the spectrum of a Ray Dalio or a Simon Sinek or something else, or a Jerome Powell says something in the market, or you've even got like Jamie Dimon saying certain things, you know, we're fluff, when underneath there is a mandate of every division of JP Morgan to use a technology that he's on CNBC talking against, when there's a variation of that, realize that you are not. If you are curious and you are learning and you are seeing things, have confidence in the process that you're putting in place. And don't doubt yourself because some expert, especially if that expert is Wall Street, completely disagrees with you. Mm-hmm. I think that will give you a competitive advantage and give you that contrarian view as well.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, I learned this from you and other times that we spoke. But one of the things that you taught me was expect people to disagree with you. Like, be ready for that. If you're going out and you're pitching or you're talking about your thesis, expect them to disagree with you. But do not ever let it be okay for them to find a flaw in how you arrived at your thesis. So they can argue it. But one thing they should not be able to argue is your research process of how you arrived at your conclusion. Even if they don't agree with it, make sure they can never find a flaw in how you arrived.
That's a good way of putting it, meaning smart investors, smart people can disagree with you and they can end up being right, but they will respect the way you disagreed and why you came to the conclusion you did. And that matters more than who was right or wrong. I think that's a good way you put it.
Well, thank you. I was just regurgitating your wisdom, but what would you say would be a third competitive advantage?
It helps to take the risk of being on the edge of what you're comfortable understanding and just knowing that you have that curiosity and that intention and that confidence that you'll figure it out. Always approach a problem knowing that if anybody can figure this out, I will, and be okay being wrong. If you're humble enough to say, I'll figure it out even if I'm wrong, over time, you'll be right a lot more than you're wrong. And where that comes in is if you're in a business meeting and somebody's like, who can do this? And you're like, I don't know if I can, and be humble about it, but here's how I'll do it. And I think I can do this and figure it out and be confident that you can take it on. That's how you rise in a system, whether that's a corporate system or whether that's your own system of getting better at making good decisions. And that's what you need to do. You're not going to just make every good decision. You need to go out there, figure it out, mess up, but know that you've hedged that bottom, that downside, that you're not exploding and defrauding, overpromising. Yeah. You are legitimately with humility saying, I think I can understand this. I'm going to go understand it. And if I mess up, I mess up, but I'm going to learn from it. And if you're in that room, and when somebody says, who can do this? Who can figure this out? Be the person that says, I can figure it out, even if you don't know if you can.
That's right. You know, you reminded me of a saying, I think it was Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook, something along the lines, like, if you were offered a seat on a rocket ship, don't ask what seat, just get on. And so it's one of those things, I think that emulates exactly what you're saying, is be the guy, be the girl, be the person who just says, look, I'm going to figure it out. Right. So that continuous improvement mindset rather than a fixed mindset is just saying, like, look, I can get better. I've figured stuff out in the past. I figured out how to walk. I figured out how to feed myself. I mean, you could really go for it. But either way, we are built to figure things out. And so when you're offered the seat on that rocket ship, say, yep, I'll figure it out.
You do it. And that reminds me of something. I used to have things on my wall. One of them was like things to avoid in investment structures that are usually fraud. And there was a list of 50. And another one was a Navy SEAL's way of thinking when they're afraid. And a lot of these things, especially when you're in uncertain markets, which there's never a market that's certain. And if it is, you should be looking. Uncertainty is going to happen. So I don't know what ways it's going to go, but I know that there's uncertainty and I can make money on the uncertainty. But it talked about a Navy SEAL way of thinking, of looking at a problem in a system. And when you're scared of it, thinking through what's the worst that could happen. And usually if you really visualize the worst that could happen and knowing that the probability of the very worst is low, you can better calculate how to get through that fear. You can better calculate, you know, I can move forward and I can figure this out and I can make it work. I've had that before. I had a weekend where this is, again, in public markets. I had a mark on our investment. It was a long short equity fund. I'd made some trades at a mark that was catastrophic loss. And I was like, I don't understand. And my brain was so afraid for the whole weekend because I couldn't talk to the, you know, it was back when, like, this is 10 years ago, but like, I didn't have immediate data that I could access. I just saw that there was a catastrophic loss in this. And I was like, oh no, I'm dead. You know, I was a partner and the other two partners, I was dead. And I stressed about it. And I remember thinking through it on Sunday. And then all of a sudden I thought, you know, it's going to be all right. It's the worst thing that's going to happen. It's going to be all right. And so first thing Monday morning, I get and I call them and I'm like, hey, I don't understand how this trade went so wrong. And it was a system error. I'd actually made money on the trade, but in my mind, I could have figured that out, but I was so afraid. Like, I was so, like, stuck in my own head that I was like, what's the odds that this bank is, or this investment bank, it was an interactive broker system. I was like, what's the odds they're wrong? And I'm like, this can't be. And sure enough, I'd made money. It was a bad system error. But that Sunday when I couldn't find out myself, it was nice just to relax and think, you know, life's going to go on. I got my family. I've got what I've got and we'll be okay.
That's right. Sounds like you got your priorities in the right place, brother. I appreciate that. So before we wrap things up, is there anything else, any final closing remarks, any ways people want to reach out to you? Where can they find you if they want to learn more?
So I'm just Trevor Welch at the end of my LinkedIn. They can get on. I'm happy to share. I've got a checklist that's 234 items strong. I'll probably refine that down of some of the core components you need to start a fund and have a successful fund, whether it's the legal side or the banking side or whatnot. When you go to my site here soon, you will also be able to take a free business assessment that will do a stochastic probability of when you'll run out of money, where your weaknesses are, or how you analyze. And that's one way that we look at what we invest in on the equity side. We'll also allow you to apply for some private debt through our funds. But that's a free service. It's a minimalized free service. If we're looking to invest in you, we'll have a larger kind of assessment. But it's being built right now where you'll be able to go on, say, get a free assessment. And it gives kind of a stochastic probability of, you know, you're a little weak on this financial side or this supply chain side, whatever it is.
Awesome. Well, perfect, man. Just to summarize everything that we talked about, just make sure you have a durable way of making decisions. Game theory, whatever it is, sometimes I call it a buy box, but just make sure that you have a way to affect yourself as you're trying to make decisions, especially in this case, but in any space at all. Second thing is just remember, no one's too dumb to learn from, right? So just make sure that people can teach you stuff. People are going to disagree with you. That is fine. Everyone is entitled to their own opinion. However, make sure that they can never find flaw in how you arrived at yours. And the third thing that Trevor mentioned to give you all a competitive advantage is take opportunities to get in the room. Even if you're not sure if you're ready, it doesn't matter. You're offered a seat on a rocket ship. Just raise your hand. Don't ask what seat. Just get on. You do these things and you too will be well on your way in your pursuit of making billions.
Wow, what a show. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Now, if you haven't done so already, be sure to leave a comment and review on new ideas and guests you want me to bring on for future episodes. Plus, why don't you head over to YouTube and see extra takes while you get to know our guests even better. And make sure to come back for our next episode where we dive even deeper into the people, the process, and the perspectives of both investors and founders. Until then, my friends, stay hungry, focus on your goals, and keep grinding towards your dream of making billions.